morning and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. We are pleased to have Judge Gary Katzmann of the International Court of Trade with us this morning, or Court of International Trade. And we will proceed with the one case on the calendar. The appellant, of course, may reserve time, but we will not watch your time for you. And you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Leo Lifshitz on behalf of plaintiff and appellant Ronald Pineda. If possible, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may, and the secret is that if you use up your time, I'll give you an extra minute anyway.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Given my limited time, I'd like to focus on just two claims that were adjudicated as part of the summary judgment motion. And those are the failure to accommodate claim, as well as the age discrimination claim. And I'll begin with failure to accommodate. The accommodation request at issue, of course, is Mr. Pineda's request to work 4 hours per day for about 6 weeks in November and December 2016 due to the brain injury that he had suffered earlier that year. And that request was denied by Abbott. In granting summary judgment, the district court relied on two items of evidence I'd like to discuss. The first is an email from Mr. Pineda to Abbott dated November 20th, 2016, in which Mr. Pineda thanked Abbott for accommodating his other restrictions, which he had also made. And the district court used that email in essentially a dispositive fashion to conclude that
One is that we are reviewing the summary judgment record de novo, so what the district court did or didn't do is not very important. And the second is that I would most like to know, and it is sort of what you're doing, is, but in the other direction, where are the disputed issues of material fact with regard to this issue and the age discrimination issue?
Yes, Your Honor. As to the failure to accommodate, there's a disputed issue as to, number one, whether the request was reasonable. We have testimony from Ms. Wilson, who's an employee of relations. She testified that she cannot say that the request was unreasonable. And as cited in our reply
paper. Do you agree that we're only talking about the four-hour-a-day request? Is that the only issue in your mind as to accommodation?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
And additionally, as to reasonableness, that is a fact-intensive inquiry that should be resolved by a trier of fact. And specifically, a part-time or modified job schedule is one of the enumerated examples of an accommodation under FEHA's regulation. That's one disputed issue.
My concern is that the defendant's main response to this is that this was not a final denial, and that he was at least one or two people specifically testified that they told him that he could come back later on and ask for more time. Is that a disputed issue of fact?
It is, Your Honor. The reason being is that refusal was a permanent decision. On November 30th, 2016, Ms. Tanner, who Mr. Pineda's direct supervisor at the time, specifically emailed him and directed him to obtain a clearance note to return full time because Abbott had refused to accommodate that restriction. And that email is in volume 6 of the record at page 1695. Additionally, the Abbott's own documented record of interactive discussion confirms the fact that they had refused to accommodate Mr. Pineda as to that restriction. At the time, their reasoning was because working full-time is an essential function, which I'll address.
But there is testimony in the record that they specifically advised him that he could come back and ask for it again. I mean, you wouldn't lose on that basis because it would be arguably a disputed issue of fact, but there is such testimony, isn't there?
And, Your Honor, just to make sure I heard you correctly, you're saying that there's testimony that they said he could come back to them and ask for more time.
They specifically advised him of that.
There is, and there's also contrary evidence in the record, which is what I just evidence I just walked through. So I think there's a dispute there.
And then the other thing that there's a lot of emphasis on is that his doctor then said that he could come back, wrote a note saying he could come back, And your client's position on that as well, he had to, because otherwise I was going to lose my job. I don't know if that's a good reason, but anyway, yes.
Yes, Your Honor. And that doctor's note, in fact, has been heavily relied upon by Abbott. I think what's important here is that doctor's note was obtained and submitted in early December after Abbott had initially and already refused to accommodate Mr. Pineda's restriction. And it is our position that the failure to accommodate, the liability for that, triggers upon their refusal. Your Honor pointed out, that doctor's note was only submitted in response and only in response to that, their denial.
Sorry, counsel, is there any evidence as to whether Mr. Pineda disagreed with the doctor's note and whether he argued why Abbott's accommodations were unreasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony from Mr. Pineda, frankly, in his deposition, he testified that he did not disagree with the note. And the reason he testified to that is, as we've been talking about, that he felt it was needed for him to return to work to avoid termination. The reason he felt what was provided to him was insufficient was because the original doctor's note said he needed 6 weeks of part-time work as opposed to just two. Which kind of leads me into my next argument as to a disputed issue here. Abbott's, at the trial court level, Abbott primarily relied upon the fact that they could not accommodate him because working full-time was an essential function. On appeal, they more or less abandoned that argument, but what's important is that in evaluating whether full-time was an essential function, they did not submit any actual evidence establishing that it was an essential function. To the contrary, we have Mr. Pineda's job description as a regional account manager, as well as Abbott's record of interactive discussion, which actually enumerates the essential functions from their perspective, and neither of those two documents list full-time as an essential function. So,
Didn't Mr. Pineda acknowledge that he was unaware of anybody who had his role who was part-time?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. And I think taking that in isolation, that could be a fact weighing in favor of summary judgment. But combined with evidence that it was a full-time job, but working part-time for just 6 weeks would not have impeded any essential functions. In fact, Ms. Wilson, when presented with the documents I just mentioned at her deposition, she testified that she had no explanation for why granting Mr. Pineda 4 hours per day for 6 weeks would have impeded any of his essential functions. And that testimony is at volume 15 at page 4105 through 4106. And I think when you combine that evidence with the fact that Abbott is not claiming here that this was an undue hardship or an undue burden, together with evidence that the disputed issues I previously mentioned as to the reasonableness of the accommodation, I would submit to the court that there are disputed issues here which render summary judgment inappropriate as to this claim. And so, unless the court...
Right, I have one question, and I think you've alluded to this, but my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Mr. Pineda did not make or any effort to extend his accommodation as December 1st, 2016 approached, and instead he provided the doctor's note that cleared him to resume work full time. Is that correct?
It is correct. He provided that note directly in response to his supervisor's email asking for the note. But yes, he provided the note. He did not request additional time after his initial request was denied.
And finally, Mr. Pineda has doesn't say that no one did tell him that he could come back and ask for more time. Does he? He relied on the documents that seemed to say this is, that he, which he construed as permanent, but he hasn't deny the representation that he was specifically told that he could come back and ask for more time?
He has, Your Honor. His testimony is that he was told that if you don't come back full time by December 1st, you're terminated.
Right. I see. Okay, so you're going to turn to age, and I'll give you, why don't I give each of you five more minutes, because we have only the one case, we may as well hear it out, so go ahead.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, I appreciate it.
Before you switch to age, let me just ask, the district court expressed some confusion as to exactly what disability was being claimed. What exactly do you assert is the disability, the known disability that required accommodation?
Mr. Pineda had suffered a brain injury. Specifically, he was diagnosed with a brain hemorrhage, a cracked skull, and a concussion, all of which were the result of him falling in his kitchen in September of 2016. And that evidence is at volume 12, pages 3160, and volume 14, 3912.
Okay, so you're not relying on anxiety or independent stress or mental disabilities. It's the physical disability from the fall in September, I think it was?
Yes, Your Honor. Those earlier disabilities, which Your Honor just mentioned, were earlier that year, and I don't believe they're pertinent to this accommodation issue.
Okay, thank you.
Turning to age discrimination, I'll address the prima facie case first, and I'll focus on the last prong of the prima facie case, which is evidence that some evidence of it giving inference to a discriminatory motive. Here, the fact that Mr. Pineda was replaced by an employee who was 28 years old, essentially half his age.
Let's stop you for a minute on that. That seems to be disputed, I think, as to whether this person actually replaced him and how old she was. Is that right? The notion seems to be that the only evidence of that is that Mr. Pineda said so. Is there other evidence of it?
There is, Your Honor. Ms. Tanner, Mr. Pineda's last supervisor, she testified that Ms. Jacqueline Wurzbacher, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name, but she testified that she replaced Mr. Pineda, and we do have testimony that she was 28 years old. And that's at volume 15, page 40s. Volume 15, page 4063 and 4158. Based on the authorities we've cited, I'll submit that that evidence alone satisfies our prima facie case, especially when combined with evidence of pretext, which can be used to support a prima facie case, and I'll jump into that next. And just for the record, we do concede that Abbott has satisfied its burden under the McDonnell-Douglas test, and they have proffered a legitimate business reason justifying termination. So now the issue turns to plaintiff to demonstrate pretext. As to pretext, I'd like to first talk about job performance, because that's really the central issue here. Abbott's primary argument is that Mr. Pineda failed to drive sales because in 2011, Vice President Scott Callis came into the company and he initiated a new sales strategy through which regional account managers like Mr. Pineda were required to drive sales through C-level executives as opposed to lower-level employees. And Abbott is saying that Mr. Pineda could not perform that particular task. I think that's important because that initiative was rolled out in 2011, and for at least 2 years thereafter, Mr. Pineda earned excellent performance reviews and was specifically commended for a strong performance in that very area. Which is, again, selling to C-level executives. And I think the question of whether, after 21 years of service beginning in 2014, Mr. Pineda forgot how to do his job, or whether he was subjected to corporate culture of ageism, as well as subjective criticisms, which easily lend themselves to discrimination, that question is one for a trier of fact to resolve. But unfortunately, I believe was resolved by the district court in having weighed evidence on summary judgment. The other issue of pretext is our Me Too evidence, which is significant here. We have four Me Too witnesses, two of which directly reported to the same supervisors, but all of them confirmed that as they approached their early to mid-50s, after having worked at the company for a long time, they were suddenly subjected to bad performance reviews. Three of them were fired, one resigned.
Only one of these individuals was supervised by the same people as Mr. Panetta, is that correct?
Two of them were, Your Honor. The first one was Karen Newborn. She reported to Frank Weiss, who specifically asked about her age, and then at a company dinner, and then mistreated her after she refused to disclose that she's 57. The second Me Too witness is David Kowalchuk, who reported to Yvonne Tanner, Ms. Pineda's last supervisor. And what's important about this evidence is these four witnesses submitted directly contrary declarations with Abbott, which directly contradicted their testimony that they had provided to our office earlier. And so we now have a summary judgment motion with eight conflicting declarations among four witnesses, which I think is the essence of a disputed issue.
I don't understand that. They submitted other declarations later? I didn't know that.
Yes, Your Honor. Our four Me Too witnesses initially signed declarations prepared by our office.
And I saw depositions, but there were also other declarations?
Yes, Your Honor. All four Me Too witnesses signed contradictory declarations, which Abbott submitted with a summary judgment motion. And so we have a disputed issue there as to which declaration is to be believed. And that, of course, is a credibility issue, which cannot be resolved in summary judgment.
Could I ask you, counsel, just to go step back for a moment to the prima facie case issue regarding Ms. Wurzbacher. So I refer you to the Nitz v. Schindler case that refers not only to the age of the employee, but the question of whether it's alleged that the person who is replacing has equal or inferior qualifications. Now, I don't believe that Mr. Panetta in his testimony had indicated that Ms. Wurzbacher had equal or inferior qualifications. Where in the record is that?
Your Honor, that is correct. That evidence is not in the record. And again, I think viewed in isolation, it could be very persuasive. Here, as cited in our reply brief, that requirement of equal or inferior qualifications has been abandoned by much more recent decisions. Specifically, the Sandell v. Taylor Lista case, that's at citation 188 Calap 4th 297, Penn site 321, as well as the Hersant v. Department of Social Services case, both concluded that there need not be a showing of equal or inferior qualifications by the replacement at the prima facie level. And from my reading of the case law, that requirement also applied to ADA cases, not to FEHA claims, which of course is what we have here.
What about the retracted declaration by Caldwell? Is that her name?
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Caldwell submitted a declaration establishing that, among other things, the vice president, Scott Callis, she testified that Mr. Callis had specifically told her to manage out a 30-year employee by the name of Roger Castle, and that there was no basis for doing so. There was nothing wrong with his performance. And then Mr. Callis followed up with her as far as saying, have you gotten rid of Roger yet?
Right. And then she submitted another declaration and said that she had wanted to retract that paragraph. But she also, as to all the other paragraphs, essentially said, oh, I never really heard that, and that didn't, and that happened, and a bunch of other things. What do you make of the fact? What do we do with that? Do we take the second declaration? Do we take both declarations? What do we do with it?
I think the court should review both declarations. And as Your Honor pointed out, they are almost directly contradictory. And that's why we cannot have summary judgment granted in this case. I believe a jury needs to hear Ms. Caldwell's testimony and determine which version is true, what she said in the first declaration or the second. She said that the first declaration was submitted to the based on her personal knowledge.
What Abbott says about it is, well, you never really relied on that. You never really denied her second application, her second declaration with regard to what was really an accusation of attorney misconduct, essentially, and never relied on it in the district court. And now you're bringing it up again when it was essentially agreed to or recognized as untoward. So was this relied on the district court as a material issue of disputed fact, or was her story that she was essentially fooled into signing this ever refuted?
No, Your Honor, it was not, and I'll submit to the court, I don't believe that we have an obligation to rebut that on the summary judgment level. We have, at the end of the day, we have two contrary declarations. She does not deny reading and signing the first one. And then months later, coincidentally, right before Abbott is supposed to file their summary judgment, she signs a contrary declaration. And she only, the paragraph Your Honor just referenced as far as that she indicated to the attorney that she wanted something changed and it wasn't changed, that only relates to one part of her initial declaration, what I mentioned about managing out Mr. Castle. However, she contradicts the entire first declaration, and there's no explanation for that. There's no allegation of any kind of being tricked into signing as to other parts of her declaration, which is why I don't believe that I would submit that there's just a factual dispute there. And I believe I'm over my time, Your Honor. So
thank you very much.
I'll submit with that. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal. Mr. Lin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Albert Lin, and I'm here on behalf of the Abbott defendants. Your Honor, if I may, I'll turn first to the accommodation question that my friend started with. I think it's important to start with the fact that I think some of what he was saying has the analysis backwards. He was arguing that the accommodation that Mr. Pineda asked for was reasonable. That's not the question here. As the cases say, as we note in our briefs, a company is not required to adopt the best accommodation or the accommodation that the individual asks for. The only question is, did we provide an accommodation? And is there a dispute of fact that should go to the jury about whether that accommodation was reasonable? I think the first answer to that, first part of that is yes, we did provide an accommodation. We did not require him to work 8 hours per day upon coming back. We gave him 4 hour per day work days through December 1st. And then, Judge Berzon, you mentioned it does say in the record in the official employee file that we could revisit that in 2 weeks.
Right, but that isn't that a disputed issue of material fact? As there were also statements that said, "And if you don't come back, you're going to get terminated." And
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Two answers to that. First, I don't think it's disputed. He says in his deposition testimony, at one point he says, "I was threatened with termination," but then when he's asked further about it, he backs down on that assertion and actually says that they simply said that they needed, and here's the quote, she said they need an employee that is working 8 hours a day December 1st. He was asked, "Did they say that you would be terminated?" He said, "Basically, I'd be terminated." Well, what they said was they needed an employee who can work 8 hours per day. So first of all, Your Honor, I don't think there's a dispute, but I don't frankly think it matters, which is really my second answer. We gave him the 2 weeks, and there is nothing in the record from which a jury could draw the reasonable inference that starting on December 1st, he needed more. He needed that four hours per day. There's the only thing he points to for that is he suggests that the second doctor's note, well, two answers. First, he says the first doctor's note says that he absolutely needed 6 weeks of 4 hours per day. That's not true, Your Honor. The note is, of course, in the record. That's at volume 13, 3494. And what the doctor says is these are transitional. They are subject to discussion and reasonable changes. So the first note doesn't establish that he needed 6 weeks of 4 hours per day. And then he comes back with this second note that says that he's able to work 8 hours per day starting December 1st. The only alleged disputed issue there is Mr. Pineda asserting that the doctor lied. But in his deposition testimony, he admits that the only evidence he has of the doctor's mindset is what the doctor wrote in the note. He's asked, all you know about what your doctor thought is in the note. Isn't that right?
Just go back to the doctor's note. I see a November 8th note, and it says, we'll need temporary accommodations as follows. And I don't see anything about their subject to discussion or anything.
At the very bottom, Your Honor, so this is volume 13, 3494. It says, these work accommodations are transitional as the employee's medical condition improves. These are also are subject to discussion and further adjustment.
I'm looking at a different letter. It's not the November 8, 2016 letter that you're looking at.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I'm at volume 13. No, I think, hang on one second. Yes, I was at volume 13, 3494. But in the letter, what that is what he says at the very bottom.
Well, it's not the letter I've got. I'll have to look. It must be a different letter because it's not the letter I've got. All right, go ahead.
So I think that's really the question here is there any evidence in the record that says that he needed more than, he needed the 4 hour per day starting on December 1st, and there just isn't anything in there, excuse me, other than his bald assertion. Again, the doctor's note from December says that he was able to work that period of time, and there's nothing that contradicts the doctor's note. There's no affidavit, for example, from the doctor that's in the record that says that, she felt compelled to lie for him. The doctor's note stands on its own. And even now, Your Honors, even in their briefs, he does not contend that there was that having to work 8 hours per day from December 1st on was impeding him from doing his job. And that's the standard for whether something is reasonable. The Scott case says the chosen accommodation is reasonable if it enables the employee to perform the essential functions of the job. So that's really the question. Is there a dispute of fact as to the reasonableness of the 2 weeks that we gave him, Your Honor, even if we think that there is no dispute that he was able to come back in 2 weeks and discuss this again. But I think even without that, there's nothing from which a jury could conclude that our accommodation was not reasonable. As to age discrimination, we think he hasn't made the prima facie case. We think that for a couple reasons, including that his performance was not competent from 2014 through 2016. They say we need to look at objective evidence, and there is objective evidence.
Well, the objective evidence is a set of evaluations that he disputes the details of. So I don't understand. I mean, if it seems to me from what I know about years of working with these discrimination cases is that the prima facie case is extremely minimal. And that the competence or the qualified prong is essentially, does he have the right paper qualifications to do the job, not the details of performance, which come up later. It seems to me that you're trying to back up into the prima facie case a lot of material that the McDonnell-Douglas approach was designed to deal with at later stages. That the McDonnell-Douglas approach just sort of sets up the inquiry by saying, does this person have the right degrees and the right number of years of experience and so on? And was he replaced by somebody who's not in the protected class? Pretty much, period. That's how I've always seen it used.
Your Honor, I don't dispute that the standard for prima facie is low. And I think we could simply turn to the pretext question, as the district court ultimately did. I think it's equally straightforward to look at the pretext question. I think the problem for Mr. Pineda there is that the standard that's required to show pretext is specific and substantial evidence. That's what the Collings case from this court says, and other cases, Godwin, that says there has to be specific and substantial evidence that the company's stated reason is not believable, that it's unworthy of credence. And the California courts...
Including inferences that one could draw from the... It doesn't need to be statements or direct evidence. Inferences from the record are sufficient, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think the difficulty for him is the California courts have said the stronger the employee's showing is, the stronger his evidence must be. And so I think the difficulty is, given the vast array and different kinds of evidence that we have here, which is both objective and subjective, Your Honor, you did point out that there are subjective evaluations, but there's also objective sales data, as we pointed out, from 2014 and 2015. That has him last or near last, at least below average, amongst his peer group. There's also the complaints.
Doesn't he say that with respect to at least one of those years, there was kind of a data issue in the sense that some of the sales weren't quite finished, even though they were, and therefore they weren't counted even for some technical reason?
Well, his argument is that that there was a cutoff point, right? At some point, they came up with the numbers and that the data after that point would have raised him up. But that would be captured, of course, in the next round of evaluations. And in the next round of evaluations, he was still last or near last. The thing about this is it's all relative. It's not just the objective numbers. It's a comparison to where he stands amongst his peers. And Your Honor, in 2014 and 2015, it's very clear that he was 10th or 11th out of 12 in many of these objective metrics. But then in addition to that, there is the three evaluations that, Your Honor, yes, some of it is subjective, but it's three independent successive supervisors. There's also the votes at the talent review management meetings by people who were not his immediate supervisors, where he was ranked in 2015. In 2016 by seven managers to be last amongst his peer group. And then there's also his own admission.
That seems like a funny process. How do people who aren't working with him rank him? These are people who are not working with him, right?
Yes, Your Honor. They are not people who are working with him. There's review, there's discussion amongst the team, the sales managers about his performance. But then again, as I said, there's also the complaints from three subordinates that talk about his lack of leadership, his inability to make connections with clients. And I think the real point here is, Your Honor, that there is a vast array of independent evidence. And so for him to show that that reason was not credible, he's got to show that, as he himself admits, his theory is that everyone was in on it. That all or most of this evidence is not credible because everyone was in on it. And that's what he says. He says that there was a calculated, there were false performance criticisms and a calculated plan to fire him. And I don't think that the evidence that he offers, Your Honor, is specific and substantial evidence that's able of climbing that steep hill for a reasonable jury.
Counsel, do you agree that under Hicks v. KNTV, that Mr. Panetta's contention that he was assessed on the basis of subjective criteria should be closely scrutinized because subjective criteria lend themselves to discriminatory abuse? You seem to be saying that because similar evaluations utilizing subjective criteria came to more or less the same conclusion, that somehow becomes objective evidence.
Two answers to that, Your Honor. First is no. When I'm talking about objective evidence, what I mean is the objective sales data. The numbers, the raw numbers, are objective. In terms of the subjective evaluations, Your Honor, I think that is exactly right. There are cases that say that subjective criticism needs to be viewed closely. But I think, as the cases also say, and as Mr. Panetta says, the question here, as in any case about pretest, is looking at the entire record, right? And you have to put, yes, there's a subjective evidence, but one, in some of these cases that he points out, the Sandell case, for example, it's one supervisor who had one evaluation that was entirely filled with subjective criticism, and that deserves very close scrutiny.
But I mean, reading through some of some of the evaluations, they keep going back to the beginning, or at least some of the reports about why he was being terminated and so on, and reiterating this material from earlier supervisors, like that he sighed during presentations. And there was one whole incident about he was 28 minutes late to a 30-minute meeting, and he has this long explanation about it was really Ms. Tanner's problems, and apparently they were both 28 minutes late to a 30-minute meeting together. And then that keeps getting carried forward without his explanation. So it isn't really so independent. They accumulate in the sense that things that he has tried to explain, his explanations are never incorporated, and the criticisms keep getting carried forward and carried forward and carried forward. Is that a fair description?
Your Honor, I think that when you look at the evaluations, there are things where there's recapping of what's happened before. But I think if you also, Your Honor, there's also a continual addition to that talks about things that happened within the year that was being
evaluated. Right, but they're not independent. I mean, they're all accumulating, and they are repeating things that he has answered without accounting for his answer.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think even if there is stuff that's repeated, there are new additions, right? So for example, in January of 2017, he was given a 45-day report on things that why he wasn't meeting the performance improvement plan that he was under at the time. And there are bullets starting from November 28th of 2016, all the way through to...
this one seems to me to... The performance goals included, as I understand it, within 90 days getting Kaiser to buy their products or to convert, which I guess what they call it. And Mr. Pineda says that's totally unrealistic. And from what I know of Kaiser, it is totally unrealistic. There's no way they're going to make any decision in 90 days starting from zero. So to say that he didn't do that isn't... I don't know if you call it, I guess it's objective in one sense, he didn't do it, but the fact that he should have been expected to do it seems extremely questionable.
Your Honor, and the 90-day deadline he complained about that, and he said that was unrealistic, and that was changed, Your Honor. So there are things that, it was changed to, the expectations were changed. It wasn't that he needed to convert it in the 90 days. And the other thing, Your Honor, is, even if there's you focus,
but it was written that way to begin with, which certainly suggests some peculiar.
But Your Honor, if he submitted a reasonable answer to that and that was changed, I think if you were to want to attribute discriminatory intent, that would have been something that you would think someone would have kept the same. But I think the other thing to remember is, again, it's not just the individual performance evaluations from 14, 15, and 16. But it's the other evidence, including he himself saying that in 2014, he rated himself at 70% and said in his deposition testimony that he needed improvement in 2015.
Another thing I don't understand. He says in his declaration, I never gave myself a number, but it's there. So I didn't understand what that meant. I never rated myself with a number, a numerical number.
And yes, that's... But he also says in various places in his response that there are things that need improvement, where he specifically says in the 2015 review and in the 2016 review, where there's a part that he fills out himself, where he says that there are places where he needed to do better. And again, Your Honor, I come back, to the objective sales numbers, which don't change. And there's always going to have to be a cutoff. There's always going to have to be a cutoff where you determine, here are the numbers that we're going to put into the evaluation. If there are things that happen later in the year, that will, of course, be taken into account in the next time around.
How do you respond to Mr. Panetta's argument that Abbott violated its internal policies at least four times by failing to report his discrimination allegations? And does that show pretext?
Your Honor, I don't think it does. And there's two answers to that. One is the factual answer is he only points to one instance in which there is an alleged violation of Abbott's policies. That's the July 2015 complaint that he made to his supervisor at the time, Mr. Weiss. He says he made that complaint and that under Abbott's policies, there should have been an investigation and there wasn't. He does not point to any violation of Abbott's policies in the three subsequent investigations. He claims in his view that they're deficient, but he doesn't say that he doesn't point to anything specific, no policy that shows.
I thought he said that they didn't interview Tanner, even though she was his supervisor.
He does say that they didn't interview Tanner, but he doesn't say that that is a violation of Abbott's policies.
Isn't that a rather peculiar way to investigate an accusation of discrimination by a supervisor by not talking to the supervisor?
Your Honor, it's unclear to me why they didn't talk to Ms. Tanner, but they did do, and he doesn't dispute, they interviewed a number of people, they looked over the records. And I think the question, again, is that you've got to put all of this in context and evaluate the entire record. Those investigations were done by someone in employee relations who was not part of the decision-making process. Yes, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
Who did not play a role in the performance evaluations. And again, for him to call into question, to show by, again, specific and substantial evidence
If he had been terminated before he was reached his 55th birthday, would he have gotten no pension whatsoever?
Your Honor, that wasn't developed in the record below because that 55 age is this early special retirement, and that's not an argument they raised below, and so there's no record as to what.
Well, they certainly have suggested that part of the motivation was that once people hit age 50, they look for reasons to get out so they wouldn't have to pay the pension at 55. That's certainly part of the theory, and I just want to know, is that right? Does the pension terminate right to the pension terminate at age 55?
Your Honor, again, that was not developed in the record below as to his qualification for the early special retirement that we're talking about, but he is drawing his pension now. He was not terminated until January of 2017. They make a big deal out of this 55-year age deadline, but from the time that he went on the performance improvement plan, he was given two medical leaves, and that performance improvement plan was restarted. It's not as if the first time he this came up, because it was before his 55th birthday, he was terminated. He was given more opportunities every time through the PIP restarted and was coached and was given these chances to improve his performance. The PIP, yes, Your Honor.
Finish your thought, because I was going to shift to a question about prima facie.
Of course, Your Honor. The one thing I want to say is that the poor performance review started in 2014, and the performance improvement plan that went in started in January of 2016 is when the process started. That's what's in the record. And all of that happened, Your Honor, before he went on leave, before he made any official complaints to ER. So all of that, the timing doesn't work. All of those things that happened before.
But not before he accused Weiss and I think Tanner of age discrimination.
Not before he accused. The two answers to that, Your Honor. The accusation of Weiss that he made to Weiss himself was in July 2015, but there was the Arnold performance evaluation before that, and there was the Weiss review, as well as the numbers that are used in that review, all came out before he accused Frank Weiss. And then as to Tanner, Your Honor, the accusation there didn't happen until February of 16 when he went out on leave.
Judge Collins, did you have another question?
Yes, I wanted to ask a very specific question. They argued in their reply brief and have argued again this morning that Sandel and Hersant to eliminate this equal or inferior qualifications requirement. Do you agree with that, or what's your response to that?
Your Honor, those cases do appear to suggest that if you just have, if you meet the other standards, and you've established that as someone who is younger than you has replaced you, that meets the prima facie case.
And why were you arguing otherwise, even today?
Our argument on the prima facie case is turns mostly on the competence, which is something that we argue.
No, but you got up today, as well as in your brief, and said that there was nothing in the record about whether this person had equal or inferior qualifications. And now you're agreeing, and it does seem to be the case, that that is not a requirement in the case law.
Your Honor, we relied on NIDS, and I admit that NIDS and the other cases do appear to say that you don't have to have the substantial qualifications.
Okay, you are well past your time. Thank
you. Yes, Your Honor, we appreciate it. Thank you.
And I've really lost track of time, but why don't we give you 3 minutes for rebuttal? 3 minutes over is extra 5 minutes, so go ahead.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Let me begin with the age discrimination claim.
Could you begin with the question of the sales data and whether it in fact demonstrates that he was 12th or 11 out of 12 in sales for the relevant periods?
Yes, Your Honor. As to the sales data, I'll go through the 3 years that are at issue, 2014, 15, and 16. In 2014, there's a dispute as to the sales data because the protocols as to the sales numbers had not been reflected yet in the records. Therefore, we couldn't see exactly what the sales numbers were. In 2015, Mr. Pineda achieved 90% and 97% of two different sales goals. Hardly, I think you can say that's not performing well. And he was ranked second out of 12 nationally in retail sales. That's at volume 6, pages 1562 and 1566.
What is this 11 out of 12 and 12 out of 12 number?
I believe that's for the 2 out of 12 is for the national sales. The 11 out of 12 is for regional or for local sales. That's a different metric. And in 2016, yes, his sales numbers were lower, but as he explained in his response to the performance review, they were only lower because of, quote, medical setbacks. He was out on leave for a significant chunk of that year. Therefore, to use that against him for having bad sales numbers,
I wondered about that. So that period includes the period that he wasn't working.
Correct. And the PIP, they did issue him multiple PIPs, or I should say reissued the same PIP multiple times. But there's two things with that. The first is they only did that because they had to under the law. He can't be expected to fulfill PIP requirements while he's not working. And secondly, the last PIP as a result of which he was fired, they'd never let him finish that PIP. He was about halfway through, a little more than halfway through, when Ms. Tanner recommended that he be fired before even letting him finish out the PIP to see where he was at performance-wise.
Kaiser, he says that the Kaiser requirement was retracted, and then there was another one, I think, for another hospital, which he said was unrealistic. Were those changed?
The Kaiser one was changed, Your Honor, but there were other expectations that Mr. Pineda felt Ms. Tanner was impeding him with. Specifically, she was not giving him access to certain computer files that he needed to in order to drive sales and perform his job. And he felt all of that was essentially setting him up for failure.
Other than the runway comment, is there any which the district court judge said was a factual statement? Is there anything in the record that Mr. Pineda has pointed to which is an ageism kind of comment?
Not made directly against Mr. Pineda, but made by Mr. Callis, who participated in the termination decision when he told Ms. Caldwell to manage out another employee. And also the runway comment, the full comment, which the district court did not consider, is that he was told, because you have a short runway, you're not an ideal candidate for promotion.
I don't understand the relevance of that, because this is not a promotion case.
Right? The relevance, you're on, it's not a promotion case. The relevance of that is it shows that they're using age, even if it's true that you have a short runway as you get older, but they're now using age to make employment decisions about promotion, and that demonstrates bias, and that goes to their motives.
Okay, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Really factually dense and useful argument. And we are in recess. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This court for this session stands adjourned.